Pamela Paul is an American columnist, journalist, editor, and author. Since mid-2022, she has been an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. From 2013 to 2022, she was editor of the New York Times Book Review, where her role eventually expanded to oversee all New York Times book coverage, including the staff, critics, and publishing news. Her books include My Life with Bob, Flawed Heroine Meets Books of Books, Plot Ensues, and How to Raise a Reader. Welcome, Pamela, to the Bibliophile.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to talk a bit about you and your heroine's journey. Then I'd like to talk about the role that books editors play in the overall story of the book. But I want to diverge just a little bit into a column that you've just written called There's More Than One Way to Ban a Book. That column deals with, well, American publishers have fought back against efforts to repress a wide range of works. And you reference Lolita right off the top. Then you refer to a different kind of repression where 200 Simon & Schuster employees and other book professionals demanded that the publishing house cancel a deal with Mike Pence. Now, they held firm. But throughout that column, I kept reading a subtext, and in fact, I even gave the article a new title, There's More Than One Way to Ban a Book Review. So my question is, are you experiencing any kind of this self-censorship at the Times?
So a few things. One is the book by former Vice President Mike Pence actually is going to be published by Simon & Schuster. It hasn't come out yet.
Yeah.
The one that went over to Skyhorse after a backlash from employees was a memoir by Woody Allen. As to reviews, the New York Times did review that Woody Allen memoir. You know, I can't say whether they are going to review the forthcoming book by Mike Pence. But, you know, when things are published, certainly they are open to being reviewed. And I think if they are part of the news or if they're worthy in terms of their literary value or their information, and those two things aren't always the same. Something can be newsworthy, but not especially of value in terms of a reading experience, then I think that they should be reviewed because we want to, you know, we want the public to know whether something is worthy of their attention. And, you know, while you don't want to review something that has zero value and is of not of any news interest, when people are aware that something is coming out that has some importance of one kind or another, then I think you want critics to weigh in.
Yes, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, and connect it possibly to the recent that you may have left. Were you concerned that this kind of self-censorship was happening at the Times and that's why you left, or was it another reason?
Well, no, I left the New York Times Book Review, and I'm still at the Times, to be clear. Yes. But I left the Book Review and the Books Desk mostly because I wanted to return to writing. And there was a particular kind of writing I've been wanting to try for a long time, but wasn't ready for it, in part because I had such a fantastic job at the Book Review. You know, that is a dream job, certainly for me. You know, if you don't like books, it ain't for you. For me, it was a total pleasure and joy and privilege. And, you know, despite the responsibility of it and sometimes, you know, the guilt and angst you would have in, you know, sending a negative review of maybe a book you liked out into the world, it was worth it. And I honestly could have stayed that job forever in many ways. Now, as it happens, once I realized that I wanted to do this other thing and to be a columnist instead, I realized, oh, you know, it's probably a good idea to have someone else step in. It turned out that I had been at the Book Review, you know, for 11 years, first as the children's books editor, and then as the features editor, and then as the editor, and then running the desk. But I'd run the Book Review, I'd edited the Book Review for 9 years. My predecessor, Sam Tannenhaus, edited the book for 9 years, the Book Review. His predecessor, Chip McGrath, edited the Book Review for 9 years.
Yeah.
And Chip's predecessor, Becky Sinclair, edited it for 9 years. So I don't know if there's some kind of egg timer that goes off in the sky that says, like, you know, maybe it's time to go. You know, one of the previous editors joked that it was time to go when he realized he was referring to books as units. And I never got to that point. You know, I plan to keep writing about books. I mean, in a lot of ways now I just get to weigh in and look at books through a very different lens and a different kind of writing. So I didn't get to that point, but I do think there is a benefit to having a fresh set of eyes, you know, approach any publication or any area of the report at the New York Times. And that's one of the reasons why they try to kind of cycle people out. So while I didn't especially want to budge, when I decided to do this other thing, I thought, you know what? This will be good.
I guess this is what I thought, that management may have felt it was time to get a different identity into that chair.
I never got that. And they always told me they were happy to have me stay in that job for as long as I would do it. So I never felt like there was any kind of push for me to go the opposite. But, you know, I think it's not a bad thing to have a different perspective. We all have our own tastes and our own preferences and our own approaches. My approach, in all honesty, like, I used to joke that I disagreed with 90% of what ran in the Book Review. You know, it wasn't meant to be for me. If it was for me, it would probably have been like, you know, 98% what some of my colleagues joke are dad books, which are books that I happen to like. So I don't know that it necessarily reflected my taste so much as the taste of the full team. And in fact, you know, I wasn't choosing the books that we were covering. That's perhaps a misperception about the person running the thing. Yep. You don't have time to do that, alas. And also, that's the preview editor's job. That's the staff's job. They're the ones who decide which books are going to be reviewed. And they're also the ones who decide who's going to review it, although we have a kind of democratic conversation around those assignments. So it didn't reflect my taste, but I do think it reflected a certain sensibility. And, you know, I'm sure the next person's going to have a totally different sensibility than I did.
Okay, so who picks the books that are reviewed?
Yeah, now you're confused, right? Because people think that I'm sitting there and choosing them. But what happens is we have a staff of, well, I should say, I'm using the present tense and I'm using the we voice.
Yeah.
And that's just old habit. So forgive me. I'm not going to say I used to when I was part of this team. But what happens is the Book Review has a staff of preview editors. Things worked a little bit different during the pandemic. When everyone's back in the office, it'll work the way it usually works, which I'll just use that as the sort of basis here. And we would get in galleys, and then we would have these actual physical mail bins where you would distribute the galleys among the assorted preview editors depending on their interests, their expertise, their background, their taste. And we sort of tried to distribute things pretty democratically and equitably. But some editors didn't edit fiction. Some editors are just nonfiction, and some editors were really just fiction. We've had editors who have done kind of a grab bag of things. There was one editor for a long time. She did a lot of fiction, but she also did travel. She did gardening, fashion. She did any fiction out of Australia or New Zealand or Japan or China. She did books about the royals, but otherwise no history. And she did mystery and crime. And then you'll have another editor who'll be, you know, have a totally different remit. So those editors will go through their books and decide which ones they think should be reviewed and which ones should be skipped altogether. And then there's, of course, that middle group that you're sort of trying really hard to determine, like, does this merit a review or not? They will suggest a length for the review. We sort of generally rant things according to 3 or 4 different lengths. And then they'll come up with some names of people they think might make for good reviewers. And then those preview editors would meet on a regular basis to go through their galleys to talk about the assignments they wanted to make with a team of 3 other senior editors. And in the course of that conversation, we would finalize the length of the review and a list of potential reviewers based on their list and other editors' input, and kind of come up with an order in which we wanted to ask everyone. So most of the power in that, obviously, is with the previewer who's making that initial decision. Am I going to assign this or skip it? And then the rest of it is this kind of democratic conversation. And those meetings, honestly, were some of the most fun parts of the job, because you have these editors talking very passionately about the books that they think deserve review. And the ones that they got most excited about, honestly, were ones that weren't just, oh, you know, this is the latest book by Stephen King, therefore we're going to do it. But, you know, here's this little book from $2 Radio or from Europa or from New Directions, and I just fell in love with it. It's absolutely fantastic. I want to give it a full page. I want to get a big name. I want to do something special with it. And then that would really kind of get them fired up, because the great part of the job, the sort of positive side of the responsibility, is like you could actually really make this book. You could help get it to readers. You could help that author. You know, it's not just about helping that author, but really about like, hey, readers, like, here's a gift for you. You might not have known about this book. It might not have been on the front table at Barnes & Noble or up at the top of the Amazon page, you know, that day. And here's why you should pay attention.
Okay, so no one tells the preview editors what to pick.
No, no.
So they really do have quite a bit of power.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, I think that's as it should be, because the book review, again, it's part of our, obviously, a larger institution. It's part of a general interest newspaper, the New York Times.
Yeah.
And, you know, New York Times likes to say that its readers are kind of curious, open-minded people. So they have a very different taste. They have different points of view. Some of them hate fantasy, and others will only read, you know, biographies of, you know, former heads of the, I don't know, Federal Trade Commission, you know, something I would never read. But everyone has different tastes. And so you want to have a really diverse group of preview editors who can kind of speak to those tastes. And no single person has that. I mean, I don't have that. I could never, if someone said to me, oh, pick out, you know, the 3 or 4 math books that you should be reviewing this year, I would just stare back blankly. You know, and this kind of gets at why there are so few book reviews of the kind that the book review is at the Times. In fact, I don't think there are any other ones in the States. It's because you need that big staff, right? I mean, it's hard to find people who can come to those different subject areas with knowledge and expertise. And, you know, I was one of the few people on the desk that didn't have an advanced degree. You know, we had for a long time, our history editor, foreign policy editor, you know, had a PhD in American studies. You have people there who really know their subjects and have spent time both at the book review and then also, you know, earlier at literary magazines or at publishers, and they can look at a book of, let's say, Korean poetry and place it within a whole tradition of Korean poetry.
Yeah.
You know, whether it merits review.
Yeah. They've read deeply and they understand the field.
Right. And, you know, and that's just never going to be one person. You know, it's a lot of work. And it's a lot of work, honestly, because there are a lot of books that are published every year. Oh. You know, my predecessor, Sam Tannenhouse, used to say that we review about 1% of the books that come out in any given year. And I could never really pin him down, like, where did you get that statistic? So I don't know where it comes from, but I like it. I think it's probably about right. And those editors have to go through all of those books. They're not cherry picking. They're looking at everything and considering it, which, again, when I say, like, I don't think anyone else is doing that, I don't think anyone else is doing that. I don't think they're looking through all of the books, because it's hugely time consuming.
Yeah, you know, that was the question, is there's such a huge number And of course, publicists are going to want to know, well, what can I do to improve? It's the preview editors. Then publicists are going to want to know, well, what can I do to get them to review my book?
They would like to know that. You know, and the way that it works, honestly, is that our editors are trained to do this, but also this is their inclination, and that is to judge the books on the text alone. I mean, one weird thing about working in a pandemic when sometimes you only have the PDFs is that you're looking at the books really devoid of all context. You know, you're not seeing it in the fancy envelope with the, you know, free packet of hot chocolate for some reason that ties into the plot of the book. You don't see the fancy cover. You're not seeing all the blurbs necessarily. But even if those editors were, they're a pretty hardened group and knows, you know, they generally know that those things don't count. We can all see the log rolling in the blurbs. We can all at this point know, oh yeah, these guys share the same agent. They were at Iowa together. This guy teaches at Syracuse. These guys are, you know, they're published by the same imprint, et cetera. So none of that really affects the way in which the editors would make their decisions.
Would, for example, a trip to Acapulco, would that help or not?
Oh yeah, that's not going to happen at the Times. No, there are no free meals. Generally what happens, and this is what, again, the editors who are making the decisions, most of those editors, there's a buffer between them and the publicists.
Yeah.
In that the books are coming in centrally through a news assistant on the desk, distributed. They're not being sent directly to the editors, and the publicists don't know which editor is handling which book, nor should they. And, you know, neither should the author of the book or the editor of the book, because that way, you know, only lies trouble. If they don't like who assigned, you know, who reviewed the book, you don't want that going back to the editor who assigned it. So in that sense, people would look at me or whoever the editor of the book review is, and I would ultimately be the person that they would come to say, you know, that review wasn't fair, or why did you go to that reviewer, or why didn't you review that book, rather than go directly to those editors. So that kind of insulates them from having their choices constantly questioned, but it also insulates them from the barrage of publicists trying to get them to assign their books to review. So, you know, normally most of the publicists know to go to the editor of the book review, or maybe one of the deputies, and to say, hey, any news on this book? Do you know what's happening with it? And then either I or whoever that senior editor might be would then, you know, discuss it with the assigning editor if they felt like it was important to do so. You know, if they felt like, oh, you know, I just heard from the publicist that this book is getting a huge amount of attention in this way, and it's going to be on this TV show or whatever it might be, you might decide whether or not to let the editor know, oh, hey, thought you should know this book is, you know, whatever it might be. It's been a long listed for the booker, although, you know, frankly, that the editors find that out themselves.
Okay.
In short, there's not a lot you can do. You can't buy an editor's attention with that trip to Acapulco, as much as I'm sure all the editors would enjoy that little voyage, that break.
Oh, just so I'm clear, though, you said assignment editor and then you said preview editor. So what's the difference there?
Oh, I said assigning editor. The title is a preview editor, and the assigning editor is just the preview editor who has who's assigning that particular book.
Okay. And so there's 12. And when you say editor...
You know what? I'm not going to give an exact number because it fluctuates, but it's roughly.
I see. And then they decide who does the actual review and how many actual kind of reviewers are there, roughly.
Oh, I mean, there's as many reviewers out there as there are writers, because we don't generally at the book review have regular contributors. That's not the idea of the book review. The idea of the book review and the way in which it differs from the Daily Critics is that the book review is supposed to be a wide range of voices from all walks of life. So you want people who are freelance critics, people who are on staff at other publications that aren't directly competitive with the Times. So, for example, we don't we don't have people from the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or the LA Times write for us. But, you know, if they work at Harper's or the New Yorker or, you know, a UK publication, that's generally fair game. So you have scholars, you have amateur historians, you have other authors, you know, a whole range of academics, and sometimes just other public figures or other artists, Maddie Smith, for example.
Sorry, I was just going to say that that sounds like way more fun than originally what I thought.
Because,
so you as a preview editor, you can come up with all sorts of really cool people and approach them, I guess, and say,
absolutely.
Yeah, that must be a fun part of the job.
It's a hugely fun and creative part of the job. So I used to say that the most important decision a previewer would make is, should I review, you know, should we get this book reviewed? Should we assign this book for a review? And the most creative and fun part is, now who should review it? Especially, you know, sometimes, as you know, there is there are two reviews that run in the Times. So the Daily Critic might review it, and then you might have a book reviewer, editor assign it for review. And in those cases, you think, okay, I can see what, say, Dwight Garner or Jen Salai might do with this book. So I'm going to get someone else different. I'm going to get another lens on this book so that the reader then has kind of two ways into the book. They might have the opinion of the, you know, professional full-time staff critic of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And then they might also have, you know, a novelist's opinion of the book, or an academic who specializes in the subject matter of the book, or a writer who comes from the same country as the author of the book. So you can have, you know, different perspectives, different ways of looking at the book if you have two reviews. And then, you know, if you have only one review, then of course, it also opens up lots of different possibilities, but, you know, then maybe even feels more freighted because, you know, it's the only review that this book is going to get. And again, it's just really open. You could have, for example, a historical novel that deals with, I don't know, the potato famine in Ireland. So you could actually get someone who specializes in famine to review this book.
Yeah.
You could get someone who is writes historical fiction.
Yeah.
You could get a contemporary Irish novelist. You could get someone who is a historian of Irish history. You could just get a really great critic who loves Irish literature. So there's all different ways in which you could go. And I think, you know, the only sad thing is that you have to choose one ultimately.
Yeah. And in this whole process, there's no self-censorship going on.
There's not self-censorship in terms of book review editors. You know, not that I'm aware of. I think that the editors at the book review try to be really open-minded about which books they're going to assign for review and about which kinds of reviewers they're going to assign to. You know, the idea is that you don't want to have someone, you know, what we would call a matchy-matchy review, where, you know, just because, let's say, a novelist is Nigerian-American, you want to have another Nigerian-American novelist review it. Oftentimes, frankly, that ends up a conflict of interest, or someone can feel competitive, or it's too close. So you're always kind of trying to get at something from an angle and not go too direct on it. But those are really journalistic kind of editorial decisions and not self-censorship.
Right. I mean, I guess that's another concern. Like, you do want to stir things up a little bit. I mean, you want to come in with some creative choice of the reviewer that they say something that's going to interest the reader.
Oh, absolutely.
I guess what you're suggesting, though, is that in the publishing world itself, there is this sort of tribal woke. Well, you quoted John Sargent.
Yes.
John was talking about Twitter. Here's what he's saying. He's saying that, you know, you've got overt book banning on the right, and you have self-censorship and fear of public outcry on the left.
Yes.
Now, it's interesting that this piece in Lit Hub by Johnny Diamond, calling that equivalency, the equivalency between what's going on in right-wing organized, you know, churches and government and school boards with a, you know, a lot of funding behind it. He calls it a false equivalency to say that the same repression, at least, is being foisted upon us by this woke tribe.
Yeah, I mean, false equivalency is kind of a lazy accusation, a way of avoiding actually engaging with an argument. But the idea there is that book banning is certainly happening on the right, largely, although it does happen on the left, where politicians are either using it as a kind of electoral, you know, way to get people riled up, or actually using institutions, the law, schools, school boards, to ban books. And, you know, again, that's primarily on the right. Does happen on the left. There are people on the left who, whether the author was, you know, involved in a Me Too situation or the storyline is considered to be no longer desirable, whether it's considered by some to be a white savior narrative or disrespectful of Black people, of Indigenous people, of gay people, whatever it might be. That also happens on the left in schools and in libraries, generally not as much through the law. So there is that. And then there is, again, in a very different kind of institution within publishing. And as Sargent noted, and John Sargent is the former CEO of Macmillan, one of the Big Five publishers. He noted that it also, you know, happens within the quote unquote institutions of social media, is that there's self-censorship. And, you know, some of it, I think, is, and maybe it's a large part of it, it's a calculation. It is about the bottom line. These are companies. And while editors are, generally speaking, huge believers in free speech, believers in art and literature and all the good things in the world, they're also each responsible for their bottom line. And if something is going to generate an amount of outrage online, it's going to inhibit sales, it's going to make it more difficult for them to get a book into the hands of readers, then why would they make that bet? Yeah. Why take that risk? And every business is about, you know, calculating risks. And when you mentioned Lolita, which I opened the piece with, obviously not a new book, that was back in the 50s, but it's one that everyone kind of knows instantly what that means. That was a huge risk to bring that book out at that time because of its, you know, depiction of sexual matters that many people were really uncomfortable with then and still are today. And taking that risk and saying, you know what, I don't care if we get some blowback. Art is important. Getting literature out there to readers is important. This voice is important. And also equally important, not every book is for every reader.
Lolita, I mean, the fact that it was salacious contributed to the fact that it sold 100,000 copies in the first 3 weeks, and it was the first book to do that since Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, I mean, look, the free press is not about just allowing the voices that you like. It's about being open to allowing voices that you don't agree with, that you don't like what they have to say, or that, look, maybe you don't like one thing that they say. But, you know, I don't think that literature is meant to be run through a kind of purity test. I think that you can have a really great novel that has women characters that are not fully realized, or you can have a terrific plotty thriller that maybe didn't authentically represent a Colombian American character in the book. Maybe the voice was off because that writer, maybe she was Korean American, maybe she was Irish American, maybe she just didn't get, you know, how a Colombian American character would really act. Nonetheless, the thriller's really good. And so I think that the idea that we should make sure that every single aspect of a book, unlikely to offend anyone, it sort of defangs literature altogether. It risks defanging it because literature is meant to make people uncomfortable in some way. You know, look, not all literature. You know, you can read, I don't know, a cozy mystery and not be disturbed at all. But even a thriller, you know, even if you just look at it, well, it's supposed to keep you on the edge of the seat. That's a kind of disturbance. It's a kind of discomfort. That's what ideas are meant to do. They're meant to provoke us. They're not meant to assuage us unless you're, you know, reading a guide, I don't know, to inner peace and meditation. And so that, I think, is also happening. That's certainly what people in publishing have told me. And since the piece has come out, of course, a lot of people have then contacted me subsequently to tell me their stories, and it's disquieting. And, you know, it's interesting too, because right now you have, you know, book sales have been relatively slow this year after two really good years. You have an impending merger between Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster. These are big companies, you know, these are big corporations. They are run on a, you know, it's a low margin business. And so if they are getting pressure from a lot of different sides, whether it's librarians or booksellers or social media or, you know, reviewers or fellow authors in their house or junior employees in the company at a time of, you know, real low unemployment and, you know, needing to retain your people, if you're getting all those kinds of pressure, then there is a strong instinct to play it safe.
Yes. I mean, in fact, I think Johnny Diamond is falsely accusing you of this false equivalency, because what you want to do in the article, at least, is to get rid of all repression from all sides. That's the whole purpose of writing it in the first place.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, it kind of falls into, look, the New York Times in general gets accused, both on the news side and on the opinion side, of this kind of Scylla and Charybdis of, on the one hand, it's both sidism or both siderism, and the other hand, it's whataboutism. So if you say, you know, hey, this bad thing is happening, and the Republicans say are doing this bad thing, and the Democrats are doing this, you'll get accused of both siderisms. Like, well, how can you equate those two things, or false equivalency? You know, what the Republicans are doing is much worse. And it's like, well, yeah, okay. But even if it's a difference in degrees, you nonetheless need to note this common thread or this pattern or whatever it might be. Yeah. If, on the other hand, you said, hey, the Democrats are doing this terrible thing, and you didn't even talk about the Republicans because you didn't want to have that quote unquote false equivalency or both sidesism, what used to be called balance, you know, is a desirable thing.
Yeah.
Then they would say, well, how could you write about that thing that the Democrats are doing that's so bad when the Republicans are doing this thing that's 20 times worse? What about X? Why are you talking about Y? So you really can't win either way. And ultimately, it's a way of avoiding engaging with the actual issue at hand.
Yes.
Maybe because you don't know how. You know, you don't like what's happening, but you can't really articulate a reason. Maybe because you don't have a good reason. Maybe because your arguments don't hold up. But that just kind of comes, unfortunately, or for better or for worse, with the territory of doing any kind of journalism, whether it's reporting or opining or reviewing.
Well, John Sargent, I interviewed him about a year ago. And what he said to me was that one of the things that he wanted to do was to help bridge the divide in society, and he published Bill O'Reilly over the objections of many of his own staff, because he wants to get both sides out there. I mean, he wants to make money, but he also wants to try and get the other side to at least start communicating.
I think that's interesting, and, you know, and it's a noble goal. I think one of the things that isn't happening is we talk about both sides. And of course, there are many, many sides. But because of polarization, those sides have become more extreme, more entrenched. And honestly, what's lost is, in my opinion, the middle ground, right? Because you can find, even if the big five decline to publish some of the more extremist views on the right, they'll find a way of getting out there. There are right-wing publishers that'll publish their books, or they'll self-publish. Those books are regularly on the top of the New York Times bestseller list, even though most New York Times readers probably aren't, you know, the Venn diagram of New York Times readers and the readers of those books might be fairly small. They'll get out there. I think what happens is, as with polarization in the, you know, the sort of general public sphere happens in books, is that you're not getting a lot in between. And again, that might run back to the issue of risk aversion. You're taking more of a risk by being in the middle, actually, than you are by being at either pole. Because on either pole for these companies, these publishing houses, there is a built-in readership. It's in the middle, you know, where you have a little bit more trouble. It's where characters are complicated, arguments are nuanced, people, you know, that's where you'll get accused of both siderism or false equivalency or wishy-washiness or whatever else. So, you know, I think that it what you ultimately want is, you know, the same thing you want with kind of sophistication. You know, I used to joke that I don't want just the high low, like the high brow and the low brow, but the middle brow, like get it all in there. People read all kinds of books. There should be all kinds of ideas out there, you know, and I agree with John Sargent in that I do think there's a value in reading books you disagree with, reading points of view that aren't your own, forcing yourself to open your mind, just a teeny little crack. I actually, you know, generally speaking, don't want to read books that I agree with because it's boring. I already know what I think. Tell me what you think.
Yeah.
I want to learn something new. You know, I think, honestly, one last thing is that, you know, people talk about cable news, that viewers like to listen to cable news, or many viewers, not all, but I think the majority of news, TV news watchers like to hear the news that they agree with. So they tune into whichever channel they agree with because they want to have that kind of affirmation. I tend to think that most book readers, maybe I have too high an opinion. I hope not. I don't think so. But I think book readers are more sophisticated than that. I don't know that people just want to read something just to be confirmed in what they believe. I don't know.
You know,
maybe I'm overestimating people. I don't think so. I think people read because they really do want to have their views challenged. And that's where the real readers lie. And that's not, you know, that's not social media. That's not people, you know, looking at a headline. That's people actually reading a book. I think those people really do want to have their minds opened.
I've just taken this writer's program, this Prague Summer Writer's Program, speaking to you from Prague. And one of the things that disturbed me about all these young writers was that, it, you know, and you mentioned these sensitivity readers. They were basically putting their stuff out there in hopes of getting feedback on how acceptable it is to various groups in society. They use it almost like a focus group, you know, to tell them, maybe this is too edgy here, maybe I'm being, you know, moving into the racism territory. I better quickly move back, you know. What's your advice to young writers who are so concerned about being, you know, politically correct?
I mean, I think the idea of writing what you know is wrongly interpreted to mean that means you could only write about, like, what you actually have experienced. And that's nonsense. I mean, then we'd all be writing memoir. It would be incredibly dull. I think that you can do your research and write about anything you want to write about, anything that moves you, that you feel passionately about. And, you know, if you get something wrong, if there's a false note in your book, it's not the end of the world. I do hope that as much as social media might, you know, whine or squawk about, you know, something sort of feeling off, that most readers are a little more forgiving. Most reviewers are a little more sophisticated and know that authenticity of each character's voice is not necessarily the most important thing. Moreover, in a multicultural world, you don't just have only Chinese Americans in a book, or only Black people in a book, or only, you know, Bolivians in a book. Generally speaking, especially if a book is in America or another largely multicultural country, you have a lot of different voices and you're only one writer. So you can't get all those voices right. And also, it's not just about race and ethnicity and sex. It's everything. It's about class. I mean, you could say, well, how could someone who went to an Ivy League school understand a working class character? How could you write this book where you have a Californian wherein you grew up in Mississippi? I mean, you would be limiting yourself in so many ways if you were trying to do everything from firsthand experience. So do the research, do the best you can. Maybe you don't get every voice authentically, perfectly correct, but you may create really interesting, complicated, relatable, provocative characters in other ways. Authenticity of voice is just one element of the many things that make not just characters good, but a whole book good.
And just don't worry about offending people.
Well, I mean, it's so interesting because for a long time, writers wanted to offend people.
Yes.
They wanted to get you out of your, sort of comfortable chair, make you sit up and think. So I don't know. It's, you don't want to offend people like in a malicious, nasty way, but offend some sensibilities, possibly. Challenge people's assumptions, absolutely. Get them to reconsider things that they, haven't thought about or have their own biases about. Absolutely. Why wouldn't you want to do that?
Yeah. Okay. I just want to move back to the fact that you left the book's editor position, and I want to look at the podcast because I loved your podcast.
Oh, thank you. I loved my podcast too. I loved it. It was one of my favorite parts of the job. I think I was more reluctant to leave that, maybe then. It was one of the things I knew I would miss most when I decided to leave.
Well, you're so good at it. And I'm not just sort of kissing your ass here. I really enjoyed listening to you. And I had a question about, your questions were pointed and always got interesting answers. And that's what I strive for is, I want interesting details and answers. And you invariably got that out of your author. So how'd you do that?
Oh, well, thank you. I had no experience going in. And I had the advice of Sam Townhouse, the person who hosted it before and edited the book review before me. And he said, don't prepare because no one else has read the book. You don't need to read the book. No one else has read the book. And you are the stand-in for the listener. If you come at it from the listener's point of view, you don't really know anything either. Now, that was very easy for Sam to say because Sam has remarkable powers of recall and he could always pull out a relevant quote or a detail from history that would inform and enliven the conversation in a way that I just couldn't do. So I did do a little bit more of my homework. And what I ultimately tried to do was let my own curiosity drive the conversation. So, unlike some other podcasts, I did not have a staff that helped prepare me for the podcast or choose the guests. So I was picking out who I wanted to interview based on things that I thought not only would interest the listeners, hopefully, but also really would interest me. Because I felt like if I'm curious about this subject or about this author, then that curiosity will drive my questions and then that'll kind of shine through. If I'm bored by it, it won't work. So I apologize to authors of books that just didn't like get me that excited. I think people got a sense that like there were certain kinds of things that I really enjoyed. History, for example, memoir, thrillers, but and fiction and translation, although it's a little bit more difficult. You can't usually, unless the, depending on the author, you can't necessarily talk to the author. Sometimes you're talking to the translator or the critic. And then the other thing is that I did my own questions and I didn't necessarily follow my own outline of questions because then you're not really having a conversation. And I remember, there was one time when I had Scott Kelly was my guest, and Scott Kelly, of course, an astronaut. And he had written a book about being the person who spent the most time in space. But he had written this memoir and he came into the office. I remember, that day I was very tired and I really busy and I hadn't well prepared. And he and I went off into the studio and I remember sitting there thinking like, oh, my God, I don't know what to ask him. I'm not prepared. And then I just reminded myself, you're in the room with an astronaut, you idiot. You can ask him anything. This guy's been in space. Like, you ask him about going to the bathroom, like ask him all the dumb astronaut questions. This is an opportunity. And that, that really kind of captures what it was like during most of those interviews. And in most of those interviews, I just felt really lucky to be able to ask someone who knew something that I didn't know questions and have the opportunity to hear them talk. You know, that's the great part of being a reporter that I missed, of being a writer and a journalist that I missed when I was the editor of the book review, which is getting to talk to really smart people and ask them lots of questions to help you kind of come up with ideas, shape your own thoughts, inform you. So that's what I did in the podcast. And ultimately, you know, to bring it back to your initial question, that's why I left, because I really missed that. I missed that.
Now, that doesn't make sense, Pamela. That doesn't make sense.
No, it does. It makes sense. No, I missed going out in the world and talking to people and writing about it.
Okay.
I was jealous of all those writers.
Okay. Don't accept that, but still. It was just wonderful listening to you learning, basically, and being enthusiastic with people who were smart and enthusiastic about what they'd written. I think that's the key, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that enthusiasm. I mean, honestly, like, I felt like that part of the job, which was really nerve-wracking and intimidating at first, I felt lucky. Like, I felt like it was an opportunity. And then again, that really helped guide my choices, because I thought, like, hey, you know, I would like to talk to David Byrne, and yeah, he has a book out, and why not talk to David Byrne about that book? I love the Talking Heads. It'd be really an interesting opportunity to get to talk to him. And there were some guests who came on, you know, every book. Colson Whitehead, every book. I wanted Colson Whitehead on. Colson Whitehead has such a great laugh. Yeah. I was sort of like, I just have to make him laugh so I can hear him laugh, you know, every time I interviewed him. Yeah. And David Sedaris, another repeat guest. Like, why wouldn't I want to talk to David Sedaris?
Yeah. That's why I love what I'm doing.
It is a lot of fun.
Okay. So speaking of the role of the books editor, this is a new role, isn't it? It's like, this is recent. And do all books editors now have to be podcasters?
Well, the book review podcast, gosh, I'm going to try to figure out how old it is now. It's 16 or 17 years old. It's the oldest, longest running podcast at the New York Times. And what's interesting is, you know, I left 5 months ago. And when I left, I passed the baton or the mic to John Williams, who was an excellent editor and was, you know, a regular on the podcast, and also, you know, was my kind of co-pilot behind the scenes, helping me nail down my guests.
He's done over to the Washington Post.
And he is now, right. So he was hosting at the interim. He's going to the Washington Post. So I honestly don't know what's going to happen next with the podcast and whether it'll revert to the new editor of the Book Review and editor of the Books Desk, who's Gilbert Cruz, if he'll host the podcast or someone else will host it or if they'll reimagine it. And partly I don't know because, you know, at the New York Times, one of the church-state divides is between news and opinion. So I'm not in the newsroom anymore, and I'm not part of that decision-making process. So it'll be news to me when they figure out what happens next. I actually think, you know, even though editing a book review and running a desk and hosting a podcast, each of those, frankly, is full-time jobs, you know, or full-time jobs in and of themselves. And so it was like very relentlessly busy job to have. I felt like there was a real cross-pollination. Each one exercised different muscles. You know, running the news around publishing and the book world was its own thing. Editing the book review was its own thing. Overseeing critics was its own thing. The podcast was its own thing. But being able to do all of those things, even a little bit, although obviously I had the help of a really great team, I think was actually quite useful. It was very useful to talk to authors while running a desk because their ideas kind of infiltrated my own approach to the book review. I would learn, for example, in a conversation, a kind of side interest of a novelist and then say, oh, wow, you know, I could actually, this person, we should assign a book review to. And so I might then get off the podcast and say, you know, I just talked to this great writer who, I'll give an example. There was a woman who had written a book about the Chinese language. And in our conversation, it came up that she also really loves Chinese science fiction. Now, she happens to be friends with almost all the contemporary Chinese fiction writers, science fiction writers, so we can't get her to review that, but we should have her review other science fiction. And so I could then email my editors and say, hey, if you've got some really great speculative fiction that's not Chinese science fiction, we should ask this woman to review. So I don't know. I felt like not only did they kind of use different parts of your brain, but they actually all kind of worked in concert together.
But it sounds like a way better job, actually.
Well, yeah, it was a great job. As I said, like, I'm really delighted to be a columnist. But if I hadn't become one, I think, you might have had to drag me kicking and screaming because it was a lot of fun.
Okay. It's just winding down here with the role of the book's editor and then finally your journey, your heroine's journey.
Flawed heroine.
Yeah, well, we have to have flaws in there to make it interesting. Anyway, a year or two ago, I interviewed John Freeman, and he told me that the job of the editor is to be as informed as possible. And I think he was referring at that point to sort of just getting out of New York and finding out what was going on all around, not only the country, but around the world. What would you say, if you agree with this, what would you say that the editor should be informed about?
Well, again, so I think you're saying editor, and I'm assuming you're meaning editor of the book review, but as the editor of the whole desk, of the book's desk, where you're overseeing the news reports and you're looking at service journalism and you're looking at the Daily Critics and you're looking at the book review, I agree with him. You should get out there and be kind of all over the place. I think it's really great to go to book festivals, to go around to bookstores. Every time I traveled, which I love to do, I would go, I always go to the supermarket and the bookstores. That tells me everything I need to know. But, it also just might be my priorities. Publishing industry will host lunches when it's not the pandemic, where you actually not just get to meet authors, but you also meet the editors, the publicists, you're having conversations with them, and you're also having conversations with your fellow literary journalism crew, whether they work in TV news or for a podcast or a print publication or online, whatever it might be. You're talking to those other journalists and learning what they're interested in, what they're excited about. You go to BEA, you go perhaps to Winter Institute, to other fairs, you listen to what booksellers are talking about, you hear what librarians are talking about. I always go to the library. I always look at what's on display. I have a few local libraries that I go to regularly. I speak at libraries. I think it's really good to get out there to talk to students, to do speaking engagements, because you learn a lot from the audience. One of the things that I've done every year for the past, I think maybe 9 years, 8 years, is go to the Miami Book Fair. It's a great group. I always learn a lot when I'm there. I go to hear, go to hear other authors speak, go to panels.
You hang out with Mitch Kaplan.
Yeah. Bookstore owner and sort of co-runner of that Miami Book Fair, really the kind of heart and soul behind that whole thing. And so I do go to, speaking to writers festivals and try not just to, deal with my speaking engagements, but then go and listen to other people. I love moderating panels also, just so that I'm talking to other writers, going through the preparation for that. I think it's interesting going out in that world. And that's just, reporting and writing around books. But it's the same thing that a journalist would do if their beat was, consumer electronics, right? They'd be running all around trying to gather sources, talk to people in the industry, it's just a different field. Frankly, I prefer books to consumer electronics. I don't know that I would want to cover that beat. But
these days they're getting closer and closer, aren't they?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the fun thing for me is that I love doing that stuff. So that part of the job, that getting out there in the world and having those conversations, that was just a joy. And I think, that's one of the things that the pandemic was really hard on, because you know, it just as everyone, no matter what they were doing, like their world shrank. It really felt like the world shrank a lot with books, because reading a book is an inherently solitary experience. We were already pretty solitary creatures, because a lot of the time you're getting out there is really getting into a book by yourself in a room on the sofa. And so that other stuff that I was just describing was all kind of the ballast, the counterbalance to all of that solitary reading. And when you got rid of that and you got rid of all those events, I think that was really hard, not mm-hmm. just on human beings yeah. and authors, but on anyone who's reporting and working in that world. It just felt like, oh, God, it's the book or the screen.
What do you think about the idea that conversation finishes, kind of rounds out a book? In other words, you know, you read it, it's a solitary activity, but then I don't think it's really complete until I've shared it with someone and talked it through with some people.
Yeah, I mean, as a reader, I miss being at the book review where I could, you know, just turn at my desk and be like, what did you think of this book? What did you think? What did you think? Luckily, I have Slack, and luckily, I'm still friends with the editors that I worked with. You know, they were people I really enjoyed as human beings, in addition to my colleagues. And just last night, I was Slacking a friend, former colleague at the book review, who's one of our preview editors, and saying like, hey, did you read this X, Y, and Z book? And, you know, we sort of slacked back and forth about it for a while. And so it wasn't an actual conversation, but it was, you know, the electronic equivalent.
Slack is what?
Slack is like, it's an instant messaging platform companies can use. At its worst, it's kind of like Twitter, but more so, because there's no outside world even in there. It's just a company, but it's also a very effective, you know, way of communicating instantly with your colleagues, especially when you're not in the same physical space as them. And we're still, you know, largely remote, getting towards hybrid, but largely remote at the times.
Okay. Do you think it's the role of the editor, books editor, to promote intelligent ideas and get them talked about?
I don't like the word promote, you know, generally speaking, because it makes me feel like a salesperson. And I don't think that's the job of the book review. But I think that ideally what you're trying to do is to give space to ideas, voices, stories, people, subjects that you think your readers will be interested in because they already are, or will be interested in because they're curious people and these are the kinds of things they want to know about, even if they don't know that they want to know about it yet, you know? Right. I mean, and which is the case, look, like that's why, you know, you read a general interest newspaper, and I'm going to use a print metaphor here, but the great thing about a print newspaper, big broadsheet, is you open it up because you're reading something on page one, it's something you're super interested in. Let's say it's about forestry in the age of climate change. You go to the jump, and then on the opposite page is a story about politics in Algeria. And you think, oh, you know, I like, what's this about? And you become interested in that. You didn't go into it thinking you were interested in it, but you're the kind of curious person and you see something that piques your interest and you read it. And I think that's what we're trying to do, or that's what we were trying to do at the book review, is to say, like, look, you might have come in here because you wanted to read the crime column.
Yeah.
But, you know, here's this other book that we're saying is important, and it's about Broadway. And you live in Kalamazoo, but this book is, you know, might also be interesting to you. I remember, you know, when I started off as the children's books editor, I realized that not everyone was interested in children's books. And so it's really hard to get people to read children's books reviews if you're not interested in children's books either, because you don't like them. You don't have kids, you don't want kids, your kids don't like books, or you don't care what your kids are reading. And, you know, the people that are interested in, great, so they're going to read it. But I wanted to get all those other people. I wanted to get the person who was like, I am 23, I never want kids, children annoy me, and, you know, and I don't even remember what I read as a kid. And I wanted to make that reader stop and read that review. And I sort of, that's the way I approached the way, and, you know, not my selection of books, but the kind of full package of it. Like, well, who could I get to review this? What illustration, what headline, how could I draw someone into this? Because ultimately, I think they'll be better for having read this review.
Is the idea to make people smarter and to make society better, fairer, more just, truthful? I mean, is that ultimately what you want to do?
I don't think that that's ultimately the journalist's job, you know? I mean, and it's kind of putting a lot on books. I mean, sometimes you read a book because you just want to be entertained or you're curious, right? And you want like some itch to be scratched. And, you know, not all books are great literature or important works, but they're just sometimes fun or what you need that day.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, in general, people are far better off when they are better informed about the world. And I think that books are one of the best ways to be informed about the world, that they offer the context, the distance, the sort of broad canvas on which to examine things that kind of flip by, you know, on a social media feed or even on a news website one day and are gone the next. You know, that's true for nonfiction, certainly. It's true also to some extent for fiction. But I also think that books remain the best way to tell a story. And I think human beings, fundamentally, we love stories. We love them on TV. We love them in video games. We love them in, you know, on websites. But we really love them. And I think they really stick and are most powerful in a book. Because in a book, you're really the co-creator. You know, no one is showing you what it looks like, what it sounds like. You're putting a lot of yourself into that story and kind of co-creating it. And I think that the role then of the books editor is to expose people to as broad and best a range of storytelling as you can, because I think that that makes people happier and more fulfilled. Look, I don't know. You know, it's funny. I just said that. And then I thought, oh, but I love books that make me cry. But I don't know. You know, I just think that books are, you know, ways to like enrich the human experience, or we're most human when we're reading other people's stories or absorbing them or understanding them. And so in that sense, I feel like the editor is like a kind of conduit, bringing those stories and maybe also a triage, you know, doing triage. We're sort of saying like, okay, there's a lot of crap out there, but look here.
So what did you want to achieve in your position as books editor of the New York Times?
I mean, honestly, I just wanted to cover books in the most comprehensive, exciting, surprising, satisfying way possible for readers of the New York Times, and potentially to bring other readers in. And that's the kind of outward facing journalistic answer. And, you know, my internal one was to build a team, create a group, you know, have a group of editors who I felt like were equipped to help do that job, you know, and to hopefully have fun while doing it. I mean, one of the things I used to say about the job of the book review editor, and really, frankly, for any editor at the book review, was like, if you are not totally loving doing this, like, then don't do it. Go away. Because so many people would love to just be able to read for their jobs, to make these fun assignments, to edit these great writers. Like, this is a dream job. So if it's not your dream, don't be here, you know? And that's the way it felt to me. I wanted to find, like, those people for whom this was the dream, this was what they were meant to be doing and loved doing, and then provide a really great place to do it. And a place that I think, you know, reaches probably a broader readership than any other books publication in this country, at least.
Yeah, it's the pinnacle in one way.
Yeah.
So you've said that life is a series of lives. So you're into a new life now. Is that it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, a lot of things are the same. I'm sitting here in the same closet I was in when I hosted the podcast. Yeah. I mean, you know, I was at the Book Review for 11 years. That's a really long time. Before that, I was a freelance writer for 9 years, working in my pajamas from home So in a certain way, I'm going back to that, although not as a freelance writer, but I was a full-time writer. And it's just 11 years later.
Silk,
but a lot has changed.
Silk pajamas, no?
No, I don't do silk pajamas. But I do love not having to get dressed every day and go to an office. But, you know, and in certain ways, parts of it are the same, in that I'm doing a lot of reading and a lot of kind of thinking, but I am in a lot fewer Zooms that I don't miss at all.
And you're open to change. So what's going to happen? Like, where are we going in the next 10, 15 years?
Oh, God. But who's we? The book world or the world?
Well, that's a huge question.
Yeah.
You can take a swing at both of those if you like.
I don't know. The new editor of the Book Review, Gilbert Cruz, just started. I really look forward to seeing what he's going to do. I'm sure it's going to be very different from what I did in many ways. And in other ways, it'll be the same because most of the...
What ways is it going to be different?
I don't know. You know, I'm sure he has different tastes. He is different. He'll have different priorities. He's just a different human being. Most of the staff has stayed on. There have been a few people who've left. And that might continue to change. But insofar as some people are going to still be there, they'll still presumably be the same people, you know, doing the same kinds of work. So I look forward to seeing that as a reader, for sure. As for the rest of the world, God, who knows? I mean, I am not a good future predictor.
And what about you? What about you? How did you change over the last 10 years at the Book Review, and what effect did it have on you?
Well, I'll say one specific thing about the way I read, which is that I did try to read a lot more quickly. I'm a slow reader, but I was conscious of the fact that we had a segment called What We're Reading on the podcast, and that it would be pretty boring if every week I was still talking about Les Miserables or Hamilton or, you know, whatever. Like, I really love a long book, whatever, you know, volume of the Kiro's LBJ, you know, series I was on. And so I tried to read more quickly. And I also tried to read much more contemporary fiction, which was not my inclination. I'm sort of a little, I have some completist tendencies and kind of autodidactic tendencies of like, well, I haven't read all of Trollope yet, so how can I read this new book, you know, that came out last week? I have to finish Trollope first. So I really had to kind of wrench myself out of the 19th century and early 20th century to read more contemporary fiction. Contemporary nonfiction was never a problem that I've always read. And it's nice now to be able to go back to kind of just reading what I want to read, although I do still do a lot of reading for work, just in a different way. And, you know, there was one funny thing that my husband said to me when I took the job as the Book Review editor. He said, well, now you can never believe any compliment anyone pays you. And I thought, what? Really? Like, but what if it's really persuasive and it sounds totally genuine? And he said, nope. You know, everyone's going to want something from you. If they're not an author, their sister will be an author, or their friend's an author. And so you just can't take any of it to heart. So that was a little bit of a bummer, although also, you know, criticism I didn't take to heart either, because half the time, you know, people were upset about a book review or a book that wasn't reviewed, and I had nothing to do with it. So, you know, I could just sort of let that roll off my shoulders. And I had seen how Sam Townenhouse, you know, people were always angry at him for one reason or another while he was in that job. And when he left, nobody cared, you know, anymore. Yeah. So I thought, oh, you're just in the hot seat. So it's been a little bit relaxing, a little more genuine feeling to not have that weight and that responsibility. And it feels, I have to say, while, you know, like, say all the cliched things about responsibility, like it felt like an enormous responsibility overseeing the coverage of so many hard-working, high-hoped authors and their books. And I did not love, I loved it when a book did well and got attention, you know, because of something great that happened in our pages, but I didn't love the opposite. I didn't love the idea that so much weighed on the Book Review because there you know, so many local newspapers had ceased their books coverage or ceased publishing altogether. And so there wasn't a lot of, you know, review coverage people could get. That just put a lot of responsibility. And I didn't love wearing that. I took it very seriously, but that meant that it was often, you know, painful to me personally to feel like, oh, we missed that book, or, oh gosh, like that reviewer really did not get that book. And now we have to publish it. We can't change that reviewer's opinion, but like, what a missed opportunity. And like, so those kinds of things, I don't miss having all those feelings. You feel bad a lot of the time. You feel bad, you feel guilty and bad and wanting, you know, writers to succeed and wanting good books to get attention. And that all just doesn't happen. So I don't miss that part at all.
Are people still returning your calls or not?
Yeah, I mean, does anyone use the phone anymore? I think, you know, I'm not making the same kinds of calls that I did, but I think that, you know, the New York Times is a powerful institution. It's not really about the writers or the jobs that we have here, but about the institution of the Times, and that generally when someone from the Times calls, like, unless they're really avoiding, you know, if it's someone from the Trump administration avoiding talking about an FBI raid or something, you know, the kind of people I call would return my call.
Well, I really do hope that you get back into some kind of podcast that's connected to books.
Oh, well, I did this.
So it was really nice to hear your voice again. And that kind of fits with your message that you want all voices to be heard.
Yes. Yes.
Well, thanks again for your time. It's been great.
Oh, thank you so much.
Pamela Paul is an opinions columnist with the New York Times.